This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. John Brennan knows as much about the United States national security concerns as anyone on the planet. He worked at the CIA for 30 years, serving under four presidents, and was director there under President Obama. He knows the full scope of the threats we face from various actors in the Middle East, from Kim Jong-un in North Korea, from terrorists around the globe, and from Russia, which we now know meddled in our 2016 election and continues to try and interfere with our democracy and democratic governments around the world. Much of that interference was done by posting fake news on various social media sites, but that just scratches the surface of another threat we face from cyber criminal and espionage activity. John Brennan left the CIA when President Trump took office. Today, he is a distinguished fellow for global security at the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School and a senior advisor at Kissinger Associates. He also has joined the ranks of several other former government officials who now share their expertise on TV. John Brennan is a senior national security and intelligence analyst for NBC News. He's in Charlotte to speak at the World Affairs Council Charlotte Lunch, and he joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's good to be here.
Appreciate it. You can join our conversation through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can also watch us this morning on Facebook Live. I often have thought about this when I see people like you on television, or you think about people in the government who have these high... And we're thinking a lot about people in the government who have high security clearances right now.
Or had.
But, yeah, or had, yes. But you are privy to the nation's most closely guarded secrets. Some of them have got to be pretty damn scary. So I'm just curious as how do you carry that around with you? What is that like? How do you sleep at night?
Well, I used to tell people that when I was director of CIA, by the time I got home at night, I was so exhausted that as soon as my head hit the pillow,
really?
I had no trouble sleeping. I had worked in the CIA first for 25 years, so grew up basically in the CIA, and it was part of my everyday work that I would read a lot of classified and sensitive information. And over time, you are able to compartment it, and so that you can, once you leave the agency, you make sure that you're not going to say anything inadvertently or otherwise that could compromise source of methods. So when I went back to the agency as director, great honor and privilege back when President Obama nominated me in 2013, I was returning to my roots, my home, and so it was quite a familiar line of business.
You had the opportunity to be the director of the CIA in the first term of the Obama administration, and you turned it down because you took issue, I think, with President Obama's decision about torture at Guantanamo. Is that correct?
No. He asked me to be director of CIA after he was elected president. Mm-hmm. And then, as usually happens, they float trial balloons in the media. And at that time, then, a number of critics of the agency's detention interrogation program came out and were quite critical of my impending nomination because they said that I was at CIA at the time and I shouldn't assume that position. So rather than have President-elect Obama go through that difficult time early on, I withdrew from it. But then he was gracious enough to ask me to join him at the White House. And ironically, I got to know President Obama a lot better from that perch because my office was right below his in the West Wing, and so I would see him five or six times a day.
So you're not at Langley?
Well, when I was director of CIA, okay. Yes, but during the first 4 years, I worked in the West Wing, so I got to know him rather well.
This is probably an unfair question to ask somebody who was with the CIA for 30 years as opposed to just stepping into the directorship in 2013. When you first were privy to top secret information, when it first came to your eyes, did anything just leap out at you and thought, and you thought to yourself, I had no idea. If we were able to get a security clearance, a top secret security clearance, what would our reaction be?
Well, I think Americans would be very, very impressed with the ingenuity, with the innovation of the intelligence community in terms of getting access to secrets and getting access to information that pose a threat to our national security, whether it be technical collection systems, whether it be the ingenuity as well as the risk-taking of CIA officers to collect human intelligence from individuals abroad. I was overwhelmed, in fact, with just how creative, how pervasive U.S. intelligence activities are overseas, because we do have global responsibilities as the United States. And so the CIA has to be the eyes and ears of this country around the globe. We work very closely with our colleagues at NSA and FBI and other agencies. But I think all Americans would be very, very impressed and admiring of what we do.
And is most of that information the result of boots on the ground, human collection activity, either by our own people who we put overseas or by people that we have recruited to be our eyes and ears? And
it's a collection of capabilities. We have a lot of people who are on the ground in different countries. These are CIA officers who are recruiting foreign agents to work on our behalf. We work closely with a lot of our foreign counterparts who have access to certain information that we need. But we also have tremendous technical collection capabilities. And many times those technical collection capabilities are enabled by humans who give us information that about how we can collect information technically. So there is just a wide array of capabilities that the intelligence community has. And over the years, we need to evolve and adapt, and we have, because of the tremendous, first of all, the growth of the cyber environment, the digital domain, where a lot of information is stored. So CI needs to stay ahead of the curve, but that's why they work very closely with their counterparts.
One of the jobs that you've had over the course of your time with the CIA, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, during the Clinton administration, you, for a period of time, prepared the president's daily briefing, at least the CIA portion of the president's daily briefing, and our current president doesn't seem to be interested in reading that. I'm told that they pared it down to one page of bullet points, and he has said that he doesn't need page after page after page of the same information every day because, and I quote, he's a smart guy. Talk to me about the purpose of the presidential daily briefing and how it works and its importance.
Yes, for a year I was the daily briefer for President Clinton, and I would bring the president's daily brief to him, and he would read it in my presence and ask me questions, which I would either try to respond to or tell him I would get back to him with some answers. I worked for six presidents, from Carter to Reagan to Bush 41 to Clinton, Bush 43, and Obama, and all of them consumed that product because they realized that they needed to have a good understanding of world events. And there was a lot of interaction between the presidents and the intelligence community and the intelligence professionals. So I scratch my head when I hear that Donald Trump does not spend time.
You think it's true that he doesn't spend time with it?
Many multiple accounts, he's not somebody who really will take the time to read documents. And so the PDB is, a text document. Now, I think the current intelligence chiefs say that they spend a lot of time with him, and I hope that's the case, and hopefully he is listening and absorbing. But there's a lot of things that are going on in the world, a lot of complicated issues that really require some study, and it's my impression that he's not doing the studying.
It's a daily briefing. It's 7 days a week. Do events in the world regularly change that much that you would need that briefing? You would need to read that briefing, understand that briefing, ask questions about that briefing 7 days a week?
Well, the PDB is issued 6 days a week, not on Sunday.
Why not?
Although there are materials that are sent to the White House certainly on Sunday as well. And there are, the United States has global responsibilities and global interests, and daily brief tries to hit a number of these issues throughout the course of the week. That doesn't mean that it goes over the same issues, but sometimes there are fast-breaking developments. North Korea, Russia, what's going on in the Middle East. So there is ample material to provide to the president. But that daily brief also goes to the members of the National Security Council, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the Vice President, the National Security Advisor. So although the president is supposed to be the principal recipient, it does go to maybe a couple dozen or so senior officials as well.
So somebody's reading it. Somebody's understanding.
I sure as
somebody's
hope
asking
so.
Questions. Through much of the 20th century, our biggest bugaboo was communism, defeating communism, and our worry about communism taking over a good part of the world. And threatening not only our form of government, but our economic system, because their economic system was so different from ours. You lived through all that, as did I. I know that I went to class and we were told communism bad, communists bad, their people aren't free, they encourage each other to turn each other into the government if they say anything bad. You lived through that too, but in 1976, as a college student, you voted for the Communist Party candidate. I didn't even know there was one, for President of the United States, a guy named Gus Hall. So two questions, why, and how, with that piece of information in your background, did they let you into the CIA?
Well, in 1976, I was 21. It was the first time I was voting in a presidential election, and already I was a bit tired of partisan politics. I was hearing the barbs that were going back and forth between the candidates, and I was very young, and I said, well, I'm going to vote for Gus Hall, who was a perennial candidate of the Communist Party, not because I believed in what he stood for, but because it was sort of a protest vote against what I saw as the bad side of politics. When I was applying to the agency and I had to go through my security clearance, and part of it was a polygraph, when the polygrapher asked me, have you ever worked for any subversive organization or, that has tried to overthrow the U.S. government, I guess my Catholic guilt, came to mind. And I remembered that vote that I took in 1976. And I told the polygrapher, well, I voted for communist candidate in 1976. And to his great credit and to the agency's great credit, he said, that is your right as an American citizen to vote for whomever you like, to express your views at the voting booth. So it was not at all an obstacle to my CIA employment. In fact, the reason why this is known publicly is because when the NAACP was holding an event in Washington, I went down there to speak about the CIA and opportunities in the intelligence community. There was a young African-American woman who said she liked to be politically active on campus and whether that was going to inhibit her chances to be hired by CIA. And so I related that story to her, and there was media in the audience. And I gave her the example because if I were to acknowledge that I voted for communist and I was hired by the agency and then became CIA director, she should not feel in any way that she can't be politically active on campus. I told her, she shouldn't be firebombing the administration building, but, to express her views politically. That's what the CIA is about, which is to defend democracy, defend the freedoms that, many Americans have died for over the years. And so, I'm not saying I'm proud of my vote, but I'm proud of the fact that I was able to vote at the polling booth and then to be welcomed into the CIA.
So for years, communism, for most of the 20th century, communism was a threat. The Soviet Union was a threat. Then the wall fell. Russia kind of receded, at least temporarily, into the background. And our focus turned to terrorism after 9/11. Is that the biggest threat we face today, in your opinion, terrorism?
Well, certainly among the largest, because terrorist organizations are really determined to try to strike more blows against the United States. And they do have a fixation with aviation. That's why every time I go through an airport, I always thank the TSA officials who are there, who are shepherding us through the various magnetometers and other devices, because there has been tremendous work done over the years by the intelligence and law enforcement community to stop some of those attacks. So terrorism continues to be a challenge from Al-Qaeda, from ISIS, and others. But you have proliferation, you have instability and war, and again, the United States has that global responsibility.
When we come back, we'll talk about terrorism, but I also want to talk a lot about Russia, because they seem to be back, or at least they want to be back, and that's not necessarily a very good thing. John Brennan is our guest, former CIA director and now a national security and intelligence analyst for NBC News. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. John Brennan is our guest, former director of the CIA, spent 30 years there in various different capacities and now works with NBC News, among other organizations. Let's talk about Russia, because they're in the news almost every day now. All of our national security agencies have said that Russia, beyond a shadow of a doubt, interfered or tried to interfere in various different ways with the 2016 presidential election. They did influence the election by placing fake news stories on social media. They even got involved in some demonstrations or trying to organize demonstrations. I think they even had some boots on the ground through surrogates at some of those demonstrations. And we are told that they're at it again during this election cycle. And the last time was just a dress rehearsal for 2018 and 2020, the big presidential election in 3 years. NSA Chief Admiral Mike Rogers said that there is apparently, they feel, no price to pay for any of this because of the way we are handling our response. How would you characterize this interference? Some say we're under attack. Are we?
Well, I think it just demonstrates just how vulnerable a lot of our systems are in that digital environment. And the Russians took full advantage of trying to influence the election by doing things in that environment, by going into servers and stealing emails, putting forward these personas in social media and purporting to be American citizens. So they have tried to interfere in elections for many decades,
really?
Both here in the United States as well as overseas.
So this is not necessarily new. It's just new technology.
Yes. But it also had an intensity and a scope that I think was unlike anything we've seen in the past here in the United States. And it was because Vladimir Putin had authorized this interference. I think, wanted to get back at the United States for what he saw as a number of grievances over the years, that he felt that Russia was being targeted by the United States.
How?
Well, you know, the release of the Panama Papers that were embarrassing to him. He thought that the United States and even CIA were maybe behind the exposure of the doping scandal that prevented the Russians from participating in Olympics.
Were we?
No, I think the Russians, you know, sort of fell on their own faces on that one. Mm-hmm. But he also tries to shape world events through this type of manipulation and active measures. And the Russian intelligence services have been very adept at this over the years.
Is WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, how would you describe them? Are they, because they say they're separate, but other people have said they're an arm of Vladimir Putin's outreach.
Well, whether they're witting or unwitting pawns, they certainly were used by the Russians and others to propagate a lot of the information and disinformation. So I think Julian Assange is rather disingenuous when he claims to have this great independence.
Put Russia into perspective. And when they were the Soviet Union, there were two superpowers, them and us. Then they disintegrated. The Soviet Union disintegrated. Russia is just a part of the Soviet Union. They do have nuclear weapons. But their economy is, I'm told, essentially in shambles. It has been for years. How powerful are they? How big a factor are they? And are they a factor only because they have nuclear weapons and they have this technical capability to interfere? Or are there other factors at play here?
Well, they do have, you know, a very sizable nuclear arsenal that right. We always have to be concerned about. They also have a formidable conventional military capability, and they've modernized their military over the years, as we've seen in Ukraine as well as in Syria and other areas. Their economy is basically a one-resource economy in terms of energy and oil. They are trying to, what they think, we would say, is to reclaim their rightful place on the world stage, because they felt as though after the dissolution of the Soviet Union that Russia was really disrespected by the rest of the world, including by the United States. And they see and saw the NATO expansion as a direct threat to them. So I do think they have formidable capabilities in the military sphere, in the cybersphere, and we have to take them seriously. But we need to be able to push back and have them incur costs for some of the things that they do.
So Vladimir Putin yesterday, NPR reports, made this big speech in which he talked about new weapons that they have developed. He said that they've developed a high-speed underwater drone with an intercontinental range that's capable of carrying a nuclear warhead that could target both aircraft carriers and coastal facilities. And he said its operational depth and high speed would make it immune to enemy intercept. He also said no one in the world has anything like this. It may appear someday, but by that time we will develop something new. And he also went on to say that we will view any use of nuclear weapons against Russia or its allies, be it of small, medium, or any force, as a nuclear attack on our country. Our response will be immediate, he said. Nobody should have any doubts about that. Why do you suppose he said that yesterday?
Well, it's, I think pretty typical for Vladimir Putin, you know, whether or not he's taking off his shirt and flexing his pectoral muscles physically or figuratively. This is his way to say that that Russia has tremendous capability and is not going to be disrespected and has the ability to counter any type of threats to it. And as I said, Russia is a significant nuclear and military power. And that's why I believe it's important for the United States and Russia to have improved relations. But it can't be on Vladimir Putin's terms. It has to be done in a manner that's really going to advance not just U.S. national security interests, but national security interests of other countries that Russia is putting pressure on. So Vladimir Putin is somebody who is been a longstanding bully, a bully in the playground, and now a bully on the world stage. And so I think his words need to be taken seriously, but that shouldn't mean that we're going to cow because of this rhetoric. But I think it's something that we have to deal with carefully, but seriously.
So months ago, President Trump said, would it be a horrible, I'm going to paraphrase here, would it be a horrible thing if we had better relations with Vladimir Putin? This is before all this information came out about the election and interference in the election. How do you explain the president's inaction, the fact that he has not put into practice the sanctions that the Congress voted, I think, unanimously on? How do you explain this?
Well, as I said, I do agree that the United States and Russia should have improved relations. It's important for both countries and it's important for the world. I'm really puzzled at Donald Trump's continued reluctance to say negative things about Mr. Putin and Russia. I think a lot of people can only conclude that he fears Mr. Putin for whatever reason, whether or not...
He wouldn't be fearing him necessarily as president of the United States, would he? He would be fearing him because of something personal, right? That wouldn't make any sense, would it?
Well, one can make an argument that it's a personal fear, that maybe the Russians do have some information that they could push out. We know that they were pushing out a lot of information damaging to Hillary Clinton during the election campaign, and whether it be fictitious or not.
Presidential Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders says that this president, President Trump, has done more to punish Russia than President Obama, and the hacking and disinformation was being spread while Mr. Obama was in office, and he did nothing about it. Is there any amount of truth at all in that statement?
Well, if Donald Trump has done more than President Obama against Russia, they need to be able to articulate that. And I have not heard.
I mean, could there be things going on that we don't know about?
Well, I'm hoping that there are, but it doesn't appear to be. But, you know, maybe there are some things that are going on. And I think to the extent that they can explain exactly what's happening, they should do that to the American people. There were a number of things that the Obama administration did to counter Russian interference in the election. I spoke directly to my Russian counterpart on August the 4th in 2016, telling him that there would be, you know, serious consequences if they tried to interfere in our election. President Obama confronted President Putin as well. We had public statements that came out. Now, one can make an argument that because we pushed back hard against the Russians and we let them know that there would be consequences, that maybe they didn't, you know, do more than what they did, because they had other opportunities to interfere.
What could we do? What tools do we have? What weapons do we have?
Well, just like when they went into Ukraine, there were international sanctions that were put on them, and U.S. sanctions, which are hurting the Russian economy. We expelled about 36 or so Russian intelligence officers from the States. We closed down a couple of their facilities here. So these were actions that were taken during the Obama administration and the waning days of the Obama administration. So it's up to the Trump administration to build upon those things and continue to turn the screws.
And although the Obama administration knew about this interference, now we really know, and we know probably have a greater idea of the scope of their interference. I'm speculating here. It may not be true. Maybe we knew everything back then. But if we do know more today, and nothing is going on behind the scenes that we don't know about, And we do know that the sanctions that Congress voted on were not carried out by the president. Could that constitute a dereliction of duty? I mean, he has sworn an oath to defend and protect the Constitution, meaning the American people. Could that be just considered a dereliction of duty? How would you view it if you were the head of the CIA today?
Well, it's the consensus of the intelligence community leadership that Russia continues to try to interfere in our democratic processes. And so it is incumbent on the President of the United States to do what he can to strengthen our defenses, to send clear signals to our adversaries that this will not be tolerated and there will be costs as a result if they do it, but also be prepared to take actions. I am not an advocate of getting into a cyber war because that can quickly escalate. But there are things that we can do that will send a strong signal to Mr. Putin that we're not going to take this.
And if we don't do things, surely they are not the only player in this cyber activity that goes on behind the scenes. So if we don't do things, what message does that send to the other people trying to interfere through cyber terrorism?
Well, it gives them basically a green light because it's going to be cost-free. We send some very clear signals to the Chinese because of their interference in the cyber realm. The FBI, back I think it was in 2013, 2014, indicted members of the PLA, the Chinese army, for interfering in our systems.
Are we doing anything similar in reverse to other countries?
Well, people frequently point out to things that happened in the aftermath of World War II in terms of preventing communists from taking over governments around the world and in Western Europe. Let me just say that I am very happy to say that in my experience in this century that the United States government has not tried to influence the outcome of democratic elections. The United States government has tried to empower governments to hold free and fair and open elections, but I think it's antithetical to our values as a country, as a democracy, to try to influence the outcome of other democracies' elections.
They allegedly planted fake news on social media sites around the area. Could that be considered propaganda, or is it something different than propaganda?
Well, there are all different types of propaganda. Sometimes there's propagation of news articles or reports that might be favorable to your interests, but then there's also propagation of disinformation and misinformation mm-hmm. that you know is wrong, but you're trying to influence and shape people's views.
Do we do that?
When I was CIA director and when I was at the White House, I always opposed any type of use of disinformation. That was just my personal view.
You opposed it, but did we do it?
Not while I was there. No, and I'm okay. Not going to go into sort of all the history and things. But I don't think there's enough things right now about our adversaries, whether it be terrorist groups or Russia or China, that we can get out there that is true and accurate.
Scott on Facebook writes, "As an IT expert, I monitor online threats like malware and spyware attacks. When our networks are probed and hack attempts are made, we block those IP addresses. Since most cyber threats occur from Russia and rouge countries, or rogue countries, why can't we just delist the IP addresses assigned to Russian networks?"
Because it is very easy to come up with additional IP network signatures, and the Russians and others are ingenious in terms of using different types of attack vectors. And it's one of the things that I think a lot of our adversaries have learned is not to leave the forensic fingerprints. And so they will make sure that they camouflage their activities in that cyber realm. And so it's very difficult to discern exactly who is behind some of these activities. That's why a lot of the personas that were set up over the past year and a half or so, I think now that a lot of the social media companies are acknowledging that their provenance was really Russian as opposed to something that was happening here in the States. So in that digital domain, there's great opportunities to camouflage what you are doing.
Should these big companies like Facebook and Google and Twitter, should they be regulated like broadcast television, broadcast radio, for content and fairness, et cetera?
I think that's a very legitimate question, and I think it speaks to the complexity of that digital domain and the need for the government as well as the private sector to look thoroughly at what we need to do in order to ensure our future security and prosperity. And whether it's with additional regulation or whether it's with a unprecedented partnership between the government and the private sector, I think we owe it to our children and grandchildren to do something like that.
There are all these investigations going on about Russian interference and about possible collusion of the Trump campaign with Russia. We don't know whether there was any collusion. The president says no. Is it safe to say that given the expertise and the deep tentacles that our infrastructure for espionage and security and intelligence have, that our intelligence apparatus already knows the answers to these questions?
Well, I have great confidence in the ability of the intelligence community to continue to understand as best they can what we face in terms of national security threats. And that's why the relationship between the intelligence agencies that focus on foreign intelligence, like CIA and NSA, to work with the FBI, which has that domestic responsibility, is key. But I do believe that they are working 24/7, every day of the year to understand that.
There's a House Intelligence Committee that doesn't seem to be having much traction on their investigation. The Senate, at least for a while, looked like they were going someplace with theirs. I don't know what the situation is there at the moment. But recently, Congressman Devin Nunes, who co-chairs the House Intelligence Committee, released that memo, which you have characterized as being reckless. You said he was reckless in his efforts to release that secret memo detailing these surveillance abuses by the Department of Justice and the FBI. And you said that you had never witnessed the type of reckless partisan behavior we were now seeing from Nunes and House Republicans. You said that before the memo was released. The memo came out. A lot of people said, nothing to it. Do you still stand by that statement?
Well, I do. I think it was reckless, but also highly partisan because it was very selective in terms of cherry-picking information and then presenting a one-sided case.
How do you feel about the Democratic response to that, which was highly redacted by the Trump administration?
It was. They went through the process, and so the Justice Department and the FBI took out things that were classified. With the Republican memo, despite the objections of Department of Justice and FBI, it was released in its full form. Now, I will give the Senate Intelligence Committee great credit because, unlike Devin Nunes, who I think has really been a partisan chairman of HPSI, Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina, I think, has worked very well with his Democratic partner, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. And I have great hope and confidence that the Senate Intelligence Committee is going to come out with something on this investigation that's going to be worthwhile.
We only have 10 seconds, but Devin Nunes says he's maybe going to investigate you and former CIA Director Leon Panetta and James Clapper. What's your reaction to that?
He's welcome to do that. I stand behind everything I have done or said.
John Brennan is our guest, former CIA director. We're coming back with more in a moment. We'll talk about terrorism and security clearances as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. John Brennan, a former CIA director under the Obama administration, with us. He served for 30 years in the CIA under every president since George H.W. Bush, I believe. And he's now a national security and intelligence analyst for NBC News. On September 11th, 2001, you were the CIA deputy executive director and would later become the founding director of the CIA Terrorist Threat Integration Center. We have not had, thank God, a major terrorist attack on our soil since that time. Is that because of the efforts of our intelligence and security apparatus?
Well, yes. I think it's been a combination of factors. After 9/11, I think some of the walls, both physical and cultural, that existed between law enforcement and the intelligence community came down. Also, there was an independent commission set up by Congress, the 9/11 Commission, that came out with a series of recommendations about making some changes in the intelligence community that were going to try to correct any of the deficiencies that existed that may have contributed to 9/11 attacks. And there's been some heroic work done by the women and men of the intelligence community and law enforcement over the years to uncover these terrorist attacks. So this country really, I think, rose to the occasion. And also, in the aftermath of 9/11, what I was very proud of was the bipartisanship that existed within the government because I think there was broad recognition that we needed to come together in order to protect this country and to prevent those types of attacks.
Is the biggest threat around the world and perhaps within the continental United States today from terrorism, from groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS or even Boko Haram in some places, parts of the world, or is it from individual actors who are either directly connected to these organizations or who use them as a stepping off point, a wannabe point. Which is the bigger threat?
Well, sometimes I think the bigger threat is the partisanship that exists right now in Washington to prevent us from coming together. But these organizations, whether it be Al-Qaeda or ISIS, they continue to maintain an institutional capability to carry out attacks. But ISIS was much different than Al-Qaeda. ISIS, when it emerged in the 2014-2015 period, it basically had a clarion call to individuals around the world to pick up arms on its behalf. With Al-Qaeda, you almost had to, you know, apply to membership of Al-Qaeda and go through the training and vetting program, while ISIS is one of its main efforts was to get individuals to be the lone actors to get in a car and mow down people or pick up a gun or a knife or whatever. So there, that exhortation that went out, they took full advantage of opportunities in social media to do that. And unfortunately, I think too many individuals did pick up their call.
We've had more people killed in school shootings since 9/11 than we had in terrorist attacks on this nation, and yet we came together after 9/11 and did things to up airport security and put boots on the ground here and elsewhere to try to keep a better track of these terrorists. I'm not sure what the question is here, but we don't seem to be as galvanized by what we're seeing in schools today as we were about that. Does that make any sense to you?
Absolutely. And throughout much of my career, I worked in counterterrorism, and I know how much energy, how many resources, how many people were dedicated to preventing those foreign terrorist attacks. And as you point out, far, far more people, and unfortunately, you know, children have been killed at the hands of these mass murderers. And, you know, we need to be able to pay more attention to what's happening here in our country. I am a strong proponent of taking the measures in terms of stronger background checks, banning things like bump stocks, banning also the ability of individuals to buy semi-automatic weapons, assault weapons. And I do not understand the argument of those who claim that by doing so it will trample the Second Amendment. We have banned automatic weapons. You know, you can't go out and buy a machine gun. These assault weapons, these semi-automatic weapons, are weapons of war. There is no earthly reason for individuals to have access to them. So the most recent tragedy in Parkland, Florida, and these courageous and very bright and articulate students who are continuing with this march to try to have the members of Congress take some sensible actions to try to prevent more carnage in the future. I really hope that this time it's going to have momentum and result in change.
There's a very famous photograph that floated around the time of America's taking down of Osama bin Laden, of the president and the secretary of state and others gathered in the Situation Room watching this on television. I don't know if you were in the picture, but you were the room.
No, okay. I was in the picture. Yeah.
You're in the picture. Can you describe what that was like? Because there was no guarantee that he was there. There was no guarantee that we were going to get in safely or get out safely. What is that like after that decision has been made to go in and you are able, because of modern technology, to watch this unfold on closed-circuit television?
Well, it was the result of more than a decade's worth, in fact, 2 decades' worth of work in terms of trying to track down bin Laden. But certainly after 9/11, there was an intensity that CIA officers as well as FBI, NSA, and others were determined to bring him to justice. And when the CIA brought forward to the White House and President Obama indications that we may know exactly where he is, President Obama felt that we needed to do everything possible to have as much clarity as possible about who was at that compound, but then to take the risks that were entailed in terms of that assault in Abbottabad. So there was great preparation, and the forces that did this were exceptionally well-trained, well-prepared, and very courageous. And when it finally happened, there was not a lot of, you know, it wasn't cheering or high fives in the White House, in the Situation Room, and in that room. It was more, this was a job that was owed to the American people and certainly to the victims and the families of those who perished in 9/11. So I thought also underscored how determined the United States is to bring justice to those who do such damage and cause such bloodshed. And the U.S. counterterrorism community continues to look for the individuals who, you know, either were involved in previous attacks or those that are planning future attacks. And I think the American people can take great pride in what its government has done over the years.
As somebody who's gone through the security clearance process that all CIA people have to go through, one would presume, and if you're going to have access to the nation's top secrets, you really have to be vetted. What is your reaction to the fact that so many people working in the White House today in jobs that require these clearances have not been able to be cleared? And just yesterday or the day before yesterday, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was barred from seeing top secret material because he cannot get permanent clearance. How can this be? How can these people be working there?
Well, it's certainly not unprecedented that individuals receive interim security clearances. But what I think is unprecedented is the protracted nature of those interim clearances. Individuals are going to have access to the president's daily brief and the most sensitive information within the United States government. They need to have that fully vetted background check completed so they get full-up security clearances.
But even if it turns out that you can't get the permanent clearance because of something in your background. You've been working there and you've been getting this top secret information. Jared Kushner has been reading the president's daily briefing every day. You can't take that knowledge away from those people. You can't do a mind meld and just erase that. They know this stuff now. How dangerous is that? If they can't get the clearance because of something in their background, how dangerous is it for us?
Well, that's why I think there needs to be a tightening up of the process, and that's what I think John Kelly has been trying to do. Yes, because there can be inadvertent slips. Individuals who are unfamiliar with the intelligence profession, with the intelligence material, once they have access to that information, they then understand and have information that is highly sensitive and is highly sought after by our adversaries. And we know that our adversaries are quite ingenious in terms of how they elicit that information from individuals.
Our presidents in the modern era have all been professional politicians, or they've come from the military, or they've come from the CIA. President George H.W. Bush was a CIA guy. We have an unconventional president now who communicates a lot through tweets. And he, as the president, any president, can declassify any information they deem unclassifiable at any time. Does that concern you?
Well, it certainly concerns me when I look at what Donald Trump has done over the last 14 months or so in terms of his, in some respects, carelessness in terms of what he might say to foreign visitors and how he treats some of these matters, and also his disparagement and denigration of the professions of intelligence and law enforcement. So it does give me pause when an individual like Mr. Trump has that authority, and I'm hoping that he is not going to abuse it.
Should there be some kind of requirements that candidates for president must meet in order to be able to get their own security clearance? I mean, just because you were elected at large by the people doesn't mean that you're a good security risk, not just this president, any president. So should there be some sort of requirement?
Well, there certainly should be a requirement that an individual needs to understand this country's history, this country's role in the world stage, what the Constitution calls for, the system of checks and balances, all of those things. And I think you make a very good point in terms of anybody can run for political office
and
without having any type of experience or credentials that would merit such position. So, I am concerned that more and more individuals who just want to be, in these positions don't have the requisite experience and background.
Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, was on this program a couple of times in the past. In one of our conversations, I asked her point blank what she thought of North Korea's Kim Jong-un. And she said, and I quote, "He's crazy." That was long before he had nuclear weapons, or we knew that he had nuclear weapons, long before he had the missiles that could deliver those weapons. Do you think he's crazy?
I wouldn't use that term. I think he is cunning. I think he is dangerous. I think he is clever. I think he has demonstrated some skill as far as brinksmanship is concerned. But I am, he's also, I think, a bit mercurial. So I don't have confidence that he is not going to do things that are going to bring, chaos. And,
given the reality of the geography over there, the fact that Seoul is what, 20 seconds from North Korea, mm-hmm. given the fact that they're of their close proximity to our ally, Japan, and other allies that we have in that region, and our own military bases there, what recourse do we have? What tools do we have? If he wants to launch a missile, yes, I'm sure it's the assurance of his destruction, if he does, but still, we're destroying Seoul and South Korea and parts of Japan. And mm-hmm. So what are our options?
Well, one option that we shouldn't take is to hurl caustic broadsides against the Kim Jong-un. But
you're talking about Little Rocket Man, and my button's bigger than yours?
Yeah, and okay. Sick Puppy. Those are things that, not designed to, I think, bring the temperature down. I am hoping that Rex Tillerson and others are going to be having some behind-the-scenes talks with the players in the region. I am hopeful that this engagement now between South Korea and North Korea and talks might lead to something positive. I think the North Korean regime for many years has said that its nuclear capability is designed to be a deterrent to foreign invasion, given their memory of the Korean War, I think is still quite vivid in their minds. But I do think we need to de-escalate the temperature and the tensions. And to me, I think we need to be militarily prepared for whatever North Korea might send at us. We need to continue to put the economic pressure in terms of sanctions on North Korea. But diplomacy is, I think, certainly the preferred option, and that's the one that we have to pursue seriously.
You spent a lot of time in the Middle East. I think you spent time in Saudi Arabia. You speak fluent Arabic. We all know that the Middle East is at a boiling point almost all the time. And President Trump recently recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and announced his intention to move our embassy there from Tel Aviv in the future. You said that this will undermine efforts toward a two-state solution and that this decision is inconsistent with our votes in the United Nations. Can there be peace without a two-state solution?
Well, there can't be a peace settlement between Israel and the Palestinians without some resolution to Jerusalem. And I do believe that it was a tragic mistake to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Again, it's inconsistent with the Security Council resolutions that we've signed on to.
Called it a foreign policy blunder of historic proportions.
Yes, and Trump thinks that he's taken Jerusalem off the table. He has not taken Jerusalem off the table. He's just made it, in fact, more of an issue in the eyes of many Palestinians. And when the U.S. embassy flag goes up in supposedly May of this year, I think that's going to spark a reaction that could have tragic consequences.
Americans have been watching this horrible civil war in Syria unfold, where the Russians are involved, and even some of our air forces have been involved at some point. Some people believe we should do something more than we're doing. Other people believe this is a civil war and we should not be involved, certainly not with boots on the ground. What implications, along with Russia's support of Assad, what does that have on our security concerns?
Well, first of all, it's a humanitarian disaster, a beautiful country that has been ravaged by war. And the Russians have just made the situation worse with their continued bombing of civilian centers. They have blood on their hands. And so this is an area that continues to simmer with great animosities in terms of the tensions among the various sectarian groups that are out there. Even though we have been able to, I think, with our coalition partners, destroy much of ISIS, this is not something that's going to go away in terms of the potential threat and giving birth to new extremist groups and new terrorist groups. So I think the United States has to play its rightful role on that world stage in trying to bring that conflict to an end and find some way to get on a path of reconstruction.
You and other former government officials are now serving as analysts. James Clapper serves as one. Michael Hayden, former CIA director, serves as one for CNN. You work for NBC News, and your work for NBC puts you on the NBC television network, but it also puts you on MSNBC, which is the progressive version of Fox News. Does that concern you that your comments are going to be perceived as being biased because they're to the left?
Well, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, and when I go on the air, whatever network I've been on, and I've been on Fox News a number of times over the years, I will respond forthrightly and candidly to those questions.
John Brennan, former CIA director, now national security and intelligence analyst for NBC News. Thank you very much for the hour.
Thank you, Mike. Enjoy it.